Marquette is the number two seed in that same regional bracket. The Badgers' first-round game will be against James Madison from Harrisonburg, Virginia. That's Friday night in Indianapolis. Meanwhile, the Marquette plays, make sure I get the right, yep, they take on Kentucky, 1 o'clock Friday afternoon in Brooklyn. The forecast now from the National Weather Service, partly sunny, breezy, and cold. Today's high only 39. Right now, 27 in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very, very excited to be sitting opposite Dr. John Swallow, the president of Carthage College, where I'm a member of the faculty. And we just had this past Friday, President Swallow's counterpart at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, Dr. Lynn Akey, who took over the role of chancellor at Parkside this past January. So it feels like heady days here on the morning show to have these two leaders of higher education here in southeastern Wisconsin joining us to talk about the fortunes of their respective institutions and a bit about the present landscape and a bit about the future as well. This is a time of very, very exciting growth at Carthage at a time when so many schools of higher education are actually struggling. And Carthage, of course, is facing plenty of challenges of its own, but by and large has demonstrated robust growth and resilience, even in this challenging landscape, which nevertheless does not make the future any less challenging. And so with an eye to the future, we're going to be talking about what has been going on at Carthage in terms of fostering this growth, and of course, most important of all, fostering the success of the students who attend there. I'm really excited to reconnect with President Swallow. It's been too long since he has been a guest on the morning show, and we have lots to talk about. Dr. John Swallow, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It has been a while, and I've missed it, so yeah. It's good to talk this morning.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I just mentioned your counterpart at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, and maybe we can just take a moment at the outset to kind of talk about something we've talked about before, which is namely how extraordinary it is here in the Kenosha-Racine area to have three such fine institutions of higher learning like Carthage and Parkside and Gateway, and to talk about the relationship between these different institutions and what a positive relationship it is that is worth celebrating and certainly should not be taken for granted.
No, it is wonderful, and it's one of the things I really enjoyed coming here. And it has real results. I'll say some people may remember that 17 or 18, it was 18, now 17 higher education institutions in the seven counties around Milwaukee came together to form the Higher Education Regional Alliance. But the truth is that that model was already here with the three institutions working closely together. And some of the results just in the past couple of years are an education pathway, which is joint between Carthage, UW-Parkside, and the Racine Unified School District, where students can take classes as they finish high school, if they're planning to be teachers. And then everything is worked out, whether they go to Parkside or Carthage. All the credits are going to transfer. It's one of these dual enrollment programs. And so that's a real step forward. There's no need for a student to worry about which course is counting for which institution, but just take a course because we need more teachers. And with the case of Gateway, we had another win, which is that in partnership, working with President Raju, we asked our faculty at Carthage whether there could be a much simpler transfer policy. And our faculty said yes. And so if you have an associate's degree, an associate of arts or associate of science from Gateway, or in fact any two-year institution, the faculty voted that all the credits would transfer to Carthage, the general education requirements would be done, and then there's just two more years to finish a bachelor's degree, and then you need to choose a major based on what you've had before and what you can complete. And so I'd say those are two absolutely tangible examples of how this good relationship exists for the benefit of students.
Yeah. I suppose one thing that is helpful to it being such a positive and cordial relationship is the fact that we're talking about three institutions very distinct from each other. I mean, that on the other hand, if, let's say, Carthage, Lutheran, Wartburg were all in Kenosha, Wisconsin, that might be maybe a cordial relationship, but it would also be maybe more overtly competitive because it would be three liberal arts schools on the same turf. And what we're talking about here are three different schools, I mean, that share a lot in common, of course, including mission, but nevertheless, each are distinct. And it seems to me, anyway, that that makes this kind of cordial and positive and productive relationship you're talking about even more possible.
That's right. They are quite distinct. Although I would say that, you know, in the past couple of decades, students and families don't worry as much at the outset of thinking about college about what exactly the institutional type is. I think some years ago there were families that said, you know, it's definitely going to be a small private or it's going to be a large public. And I think we see less of that. What we see more of is, like most American families, families here, let's say in the Midwest, will say, well, I think my son or daughter is probably going to go to college somewhere within a 50-mile radius or 100-mile radius, and so let's just go visit. And so, of course, they have sometimes different ideas about the programs and the futures they want, but the institutional type seems to matter a bit less than it did in the past.
I hadn't stopped to think about that, but I think you're absolutely right. And probably the fact that there is this easy flow between different types of institutions that I'm pretty sure didn't exist 30 years ago, that also has this sense of making it seem like it's all part of the same universe, even if it's different planets, but we are all dwelling in the same space and, of course, all working for the same goal. I said at the outset that one of the things that is really gratifying about the college where you and I work is the fact that it has demonstrated some really amazing, robust, and resilient growth in a landscape that has been so challenging for so many colleges and universities. I wonder if maybe you can kind of put some numerical teeth into what I just said. I mean, maybe give some specifics in terms of the nature of the growth that you have seen and maybe to what you would attribute that growth in light of the decline that so many other schools are experiencing right now.
Sure, Greg. Well, it is a very challenging time for higher education in the Midwest. The number of students going to college, the number of students some coming out of high school choosing to go into the workforce instead, which I think is great for those who need to earn some income first. But down the road, it's important for many people to support our economy to have some education past high school, whether that's at a two-year or four-year institution. And it's true that we're starting to see in some of the rural areas and some institutions that haven't been as strong in enrollment growth, we've seen some terrible outcomes. So Cardinal Stritch in Milwaukee, Northland announced that they will likely close UW-Milwaukee at Waukesha. There was just news about that. In St. Louis, Fontbonne is closing. So it's a difficult time. And within that context, we feel truly blessed that a lot of the things we've been working on, certainly through the pandemic, have been working out. And so, for instance, over the last 4 years, if you look at the size of the first-year class, so the students we recruit, the average Wisconsin private institution was down 6.5%. The average public was down 3.5%, 3.6%, let's say. And then Carthage was up 14%. So that's just truly remarkable. And, of course, a lot of folks want to know why. And I'd say, well, we have great people, and that already is an attractor for students and families. When they come to visit, it makes a difference. Yes, we're by the lake, and of course that makes a difference, but they get to meet Carthage folks. At the same time, there's a lot of effort at Carthage among our faculty to launch programs or to refine programs that students and families are interested in. The most recent is engineering, where we've been investing quite a bit. But it's not only engineering. Nursing is growing. There's a Bachelor of Music in Music Theater that has taken off. I can't tell you how many students are coming for that. It's incredible. And for the existing programs, we have more and more people getting out into high schools, talking about the good work we're doing, and it just makes a difference. So our recipe, if there is one, is that it's a liberal arts college with extraordinarily wide opportunity, over 50 majors, liberal arts through the professional fields, and it's human scale. And so we continue to add opportunities. That's part of the recipe, is if we find something that we haven't been doing that many students would like, we just go ahead and do it. And so very proud of all the work of the faculty and staff to get that going.
We'll dig into some of those specifics in just a little bit. I think it would be interesting to talk for a moment about what makes this such a challenging time for the world of higher education, and particularly in the Midwest. And maybe we could at least briefly touch on both of those. I mean, first of all, just higher education in general, but also particularly in the Midwest. What is going on in the Midwest that is leading to some of these really painful difficulties?
Well, you only have to pick up the newspaper on any given day to find some problem that people are talking about with higher education, questioning the value of it, whether it's politically motivated, whether people are able to say what they think, whether there are too many loans. I mean, the list goes on. And to the extent that higher education has become a political football, then you hear about it in every campaign. And so that's not getting any easier. When it comes to the Midwest in particular, the Midwest is one of two regions of the country where we're seeing what's called a demographic cliff. So this is yet to come, although the early parts are happening. And what that means is there will be fewer high school graduates. And when there are fewer high school graduates overall, not that all go to college, but it will certainly shrink the number of people going to college, which will cause, as it would in any industry, some real difficulty in consolidation. And the reason for this is that at the Great Recession, which I have come to appreciate as having changed many, many things, it's taken me a while to understand that, but going back to the Great Recession, the birth rate fell, particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest. And it stayed down. And so there are a lot of babies who weren't born. And if we could have gone back and, you know, had a real pro-family incentive program, higher education should have done that. But what we're seeing today, so why did KUSD have a right-sizing project? Why does RUSD have a significant budget deficit? It's just that there are fewer students. And so we're about to see that. So that's going to come in short order. But what's already happened to make it worse is, yes, we had the pandemic, which made it difficult for a lot of families. And then other things have happened. The college going rate dropped. You know, local wages have gone up. And so a lot of students who might have gone or on the bubble about college decided not to, at least for now. And then this year, I just have to mention it, this FAFSA debacle. Part of the way most families go to college is to receive some federal aid, either in loans or grants. And the Department of Education is extraordinarily late this year in getting rolling out the new FAFSA. Now, I'm a big fan of the new FAFSA. It's fewer questions, easier, easier for families. But that's also introduced disruption, let's say, into this whole process. And so that's why about half the Wisconsin privates, for instance, are down in deposits over last year. And so every year we seem to have something, some new challenge. But going forward, that demographic cliff is really going to cause significant change.
Right. I'm curious at what point in time really serious conversation about that began to occur. And for instance, for as long as you've been at Carthage, and how long has that been now?
This is my seventh year.
Seventh year, okay. So, I mean, from the day you were at Carthage, was this already very much a topic of conversation? It's such an interesting phenomenon because it's this thing that people have seen coming, but it's a real slow-moving sort of thing in some ways.
Yes. I think it was part of the conversation, but it's hard, and this is very important, it's hard for a lot of folks in higher education to appreciate this because it turns out that what we all lived through, I mean, my entire career was a period of time when the fundamentals were all growing, more net tuition, more students coming out of high school. So you get in this mode of imagining that you're always in growth. Mm. And Carthage, you know, grew actually unusually, and so should be quite proud of that from, let's say, the early 2000s.
Right.
But the whole industry, if you want to call it that, had growth. And so the very idea that there could be fewer students and that we all have to become more competitive and that we have to be more responsive and that schools may actually close, this just seemed totally out of the realm of possibility. Hmm. So even as I read these statistics, and there's an economist at Carleton College, Nathan Graw, who's written and talked about it, there was still the sense of, really? Could this happen? But I've talked to a lot of folks in business who said, if I could predict the number of customers I had a few years from now, I would be so happy, even if it were smaller, because I'd never know what's coming. So this is a sad one. I mean, it really is sad for us, but we do know it's coming. And we can see it in the school districts. We're just a little delayed.
Right. I'm curious. I don't know that I've ever asked anybody this before, but is this a cliff that plunges and then stays, or is this a relatively momentary phenomenon in kind of the sweep of history? I mean, in other words, was there something of a rebound, or has that depressed birth rate sort of remained largely in place?
Well, I wish I had good news, Greg. when I came to Carthage in 2017, the predictions were going out to about 2030. And so it would drop from 2026, where the demographic cliff would start. And then, of course, it takes 4 years to propagate all the way through a four-year institution because each class is going to be a bit smaller. But we all hoped that after 2030 it'd be kind of flat. But now new predictions, I would just say forecasts, actually, because we know how many births there are in this country. This is something we know.
Right.
And it looks worse. So it looks like it's going to be yet smaller. Mm. And so unless there's some compensating factor, like we convince lots of small children to move here from Florida, which seems unlikely, or there's a lot of significant immigration or something like that, none of which I think is particularly likely, I think we really are going to face this for years to come.
Right. So that, of course, shapes a lot of decisions that ultimately then get made in terms of how we do what we do in the world of higher education. And I'm reminded that, I wish I could think of who the author was. A few months ago, I interviewed an author who kind of talked about this. And basically, one of his central points was that the typical college and university, in many respects, has changed less than just about any other major institution. I mean, for centuries, we have lived with the original model, if you will, of how colleges and universities function, which is one of the reasons why, as you kind of characterized, it's so sort of shocking and earth-shaking when we start thinking about having to make perhaps profound changes in how we do things. But those are profound changes that have happened in other sectors of society, and we have perhaps blissfully assumed we would be, for some reason, immune to that. You're painting a picture in which we are not, and we have to really rethink some of the fundamentals of what we do and why we do them and how we do them.
That's right. I mean, there was a significant contraction in higher education in the United States in the 70s, and I think a lot about that because some listeners may know that Carthage moved to Kenosha in 1962, an enormous undertaking, and then opened with 300 I'd say, traditional students in 1962. But that was during an enrollment boom. And so the idea of moving to a new place, building some buildings at significant expense, and being sure that you'd have students, that was what the 60s looked like. And in fact, that was when UW Parkside was declared, in the late 60s. And then in the 70s, many fewer people were going to college. And so those were very difficult times. So most of us don't remember them, but there is some relatively recent precedent to look at about that.
Right. So one of the things that I find intriguing about your own history in terms of what you did before you came to Carthage is the position that you had at your previous institution, which is not exactly the position you have at Carthage. And in some respects, if I remember correctly, it was an even wider position in terms of what your responsibilities were. I wonder if you could just briefly remind our listeners about that, because I'm curious if you find that that is helpful to you now in terms of how you need to look at Carthage and this reality and thinking about the best, most beneficial way forward.
Well, at my last position, which was at Sewanee, or the University of the South, a liberal arts college and Episcopal Seminary in Tennessee, I was what was called the provost and chief operating officer. And the joke at the time with the president I served under, John McArdle, which was that he'd really like to have just one direct report, and that that way he could manage me, and then he wouldn't have to worry about anything else. And we never did get there, but over my time there, academics was under me, finance was under me, HR, facilities, it did keep growing. And I think as the chief operating officer, I developed a real passion for an institution working well. You know, the train's running on time. Families know what to expect, and we deliver it. So in some ways, simple things. But, you know, in an organization, things can get really complicated and siloed. And so I still have that passion. And I'd say at Carthage, that's part of why we've really attended to a lot of the replacement of systems and buildings, boilers. I mean, none of the stuff that's really exciting, but I just can't have it go wrong. Because it's very important, amidst all the other things we're doing, to make sure there's not some emergency, and you can count on software systems. We have many new software systems. Registration is simple. Our finance system has been replaced. Our student success software has been introduced. Our fundraising software is different. All of these things so that we can do the work we want to do and do it efficiently and spend more time on one-on-one relationships. Now, I will say that, when you do something for a while, sometimes it can be kind of hard to let it go and delegate it. And so I do feel fine and actually enormously confident in the team. But sometimes I have to tell myself, there is some problem and it's getting resolved and I don't need to worry about it because I know great people are working on it and I should be spending my time on other things, again, on relationships, on fundraising, and on strategy. So that is part of my evolution.
Interesting. Right. Well, then it's interesting, too, that, I mean, not only are boilers not particularly interesting unless, maybe that's your line of work or something, but they're also not, anything directly to do with academics except you have to keep your buildings warm. I mean, it is this infrastructure that matters tremendously, but those of us who teach for a living, don't tend to think about those things until suddenly there's no heat in the building. So
absolutely. One joke in academia is that, it's all about preparing students for the future. And then it comes down to something like if you get food wrong or parking wrong, like it all falls apart because people get very upset. But it's true. And Carthage was lucky. I mean, the transition to Kenosha, of course, was an enormous challenge. People had to move. But one of the consequences was the buildings. There was a big building program in the 60s and 70s. And then there was another building program in the early 2000s. And Carthage didn't have to face what happens when buildings get 50, 60, 70 years old. So that was a lucky part. But now that we all live in this time, Carthage has to go back and worry about those things. And so it's lovely to keep building new buildings, but you got to keep the ones you have in tip-top shape.
For sure. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. John Swallow, the president of Carthage College. And we are talking about a number of different challenges as well as opportunities confronting Carthage at this point in time. So President Swallow, as we're talking about this very challenging landscape, which is likely to grow still more challenging, one of the intriguing matters, of course, is what to do about that, to think about growth and expansion and creation of new things at a time when probably there are other factors that, you know, would make it seem like retreat and shrinkage is you know, inevitable and something to embrace. And obviously that doesn't make sense to, in a sense, give in to those forces. So talk for a moment about the way in which you and your advisors and the trustees are thinking about matters of growth and expansion in this particular landscape. What do you have to think about? Maybe how do you have to approach the matter of growth and expansion and elimination too, at this point in time versus the way you could once upon a time think about growth and expansion?
Yeah, so there's really two parts to growth. So one is these new programs, and I'd say the need to identify, have good market research on, and then launch new programs with relative speed is very important because of all the things I just mentioned, how dynamic the whole situation is and how competitive it is. And you can get a first mover advantage if you are early in a market of students identifying it. And I would say we're fairly early in launching engineering compared to some other institutions. But everyone is going to try to catch up. That's just the nature of things. And so you do want to move quickly. And I'd say that's different from the past when it seemed like things were very stable. And so you could think long and hard, maybe even for several years, about whether you wanted to start a program. Now we simply have to take good, calculated risks. And not all will work. We have to acknowledge that and give ourselves some freedom to fail, not that we're hoping for it, and then learn from it. And then there's another part to growth, which is ensuring that the students that do start at Carthage retain and graduate. And this is a place where there's such a moral reason to work on this, which is that we want all students to succeed. And I think one of higher education's failings has been that it has been easy to say, well, we admit students and, you know, then it's completely up to them. Well, of course, we have to have a lot of personal responsibility and students need to study and all those things. But the environment, the system can hold them back and introduce obstacles that are simply unnecessary. And we don't always see those because, you know, we're in our 50s or 60s and we're not going through it. And so one of the things we've been working on is trying to identify different groups of students and remove obstacles, provide more support, and then even provide targeted financial aid. So, for instance, under the Carthage commitment, if you're from a family earning $65,000 or less and you're in Wisconsin, then after federal grants and loans and state grants, you don't have to pay anything out of pocket in tuition. So we didn't have that before. We've had some emergency grants to help students who get in a bind. And this is actually more important than many people realize. And so the results from this great work across campus, a particular program, for instance, that was in the news called Carthage Bound, which was trying to support football players, many of who come from further away, has resulted in our retention rates going up quite a bit, first to second year. So it was 74%, now it's 82%. And then a lot of the, you can call them equity gaps or achievement gaps, closed dramatically. Our black student retention rate was 82, the same. Our students of color overall was 79. Our Hispanic students, in particular, when it got up to 76, when it had been 10 percentage points worse. First-generation students, people from families who hadn't had someone go to college, that went up 10 percentage points. Low-income students went up almost 20 percentage points.
Wow.
This is dramatic, I have to say, and give enormous credit to all the faculty and staff working on this, including Abby Hanna, who's our EVP for administration and leading our Moonshot initiative around equity, and Michelle Hancock, who has been leading some very targeted programs for students of color. And together, these results are so remarkable that we're leading this moonshot of equity program nationwide. You may have heard that many schools locally have joined Parkside, Milwaukee Area Technical College, recently Gateway, UW-Milwaukee. And there was recently a webinar where Abby Hanna was just reviewing what we did, and over 200 people from across the country signed into this webinar.
Wow.
To try to figure out how they could do the same. And, of course, we want them to do the same. Everybody should be serving their students better, and so we're happy to share these results. So part of growth is bringing more new people in, and part of growth is making sure that everyone succeeds and stays the whole 4 years.
Right, absolutely, and particularly in this landscape where the pool is shrinking so dramatically, you don't, on top of it, want to lose too many of the students who you have managed to attract to the school in the first place. Yeah, those are some spectacular numbers. I guess we probably don't have time to go real thoroughly, but maybe you could touch on one or two aspects of this success story that you think maybe our listeners could appreciate and understand. I mean, in terms of what has been most crucial to this tremendous success involving the improvement in retention.
Well, I'll start with the Carthage Bound program, where we identified that one of the biggest opportunities to improve retention overall was for our football players. And this is a place where there can be lots of assumptions and some that people will talk about and some that won't, about whether our football players are good students or whether they have good study habits. And like all students, they can use some support. One thing we found out was that they come several weeks early. And so they're coming to college at a time when there aren't many people in the dorms. It's not as lively. Mm. And they could use some targeted support, particularly meeting all the people that can help them. Because, in fact, they were becoming part of our campus community without going through the orientation that most students went through.
Mm.
And so Michelle Good Hancock point. Asked for volunteers and got volunteers across campus to meet all the new football players, to talk to them, establish contacts. And that made an enormous difference. And once those contacts were made, we kept on. You know, it wasn't just a one-off. And she maintained a personal relationship with them. And that made a huge, huge difference. So that's, if the program was so successful, we decided to expand it to other groups. Not that it has to be athletic teams in particular, but when you just look at the statistics and try to identify what the next group might be, then we identified soccer as next. And again, other sports, they're doing just fine. Swimmers tend to do just fine. So there are certain sports that, for a variety of reasons, have students come who need some more support. And the beautiful thing about this, Greg, is that when you start to do this and you start to work on all these obstacles, you could wonder if you're only helping certain groups of students. But once you get in the mood or the mode of removing obstacles, it turns out you're removing obstacles for everyone. Like, if you're thinking about additional financial aid and you're thinking about it really smartly, then you start realizing that certain families need some more aid and you can target it better. And by doing that, then it lifts everybody.
Mm.
And that's what we saw. It wasn't just football players who had better retention. It was music students. It was white students. It was students from further away and students from close in. And so that's just it sort of proves the need to work on this at all levels. But the ideas have to be very targeted. Some of the ideas from the past haven't always worked, and this is where we need some freedom to innovate, and then try to understand what does work and what can be scaled. Because as we know, given this environment, we have limited resources.
Right. I was especially excited to hear you mention the improvement in retention of first-generation college students. And my understanding is that that has long been a reality at Carthage, that we have had, maybe compared to some of our sister institutions, have had a very large number of first-generation students, which, of course, in and of itself is such an exciting thing. But on the other hand, that has also been a point in which many of those students, for a variety of reasons, have struggled to flourish or perhaps even graduate. Not all, but a significant number. And I'm just so happy to hear that attention has been given to that particular population, because there's all kinds of reasons to do so.
Yes. Higher education can sometimes experience the bad consequences of focusing on itself too much. the truth is there are more first-generation faculty and staff than you would think, and that has gotten obscured, though. And one way that this gets obscured is that we start to use language that a family who hasn't gone to college might not know. There's all kinds of jargon. And so, again, this gets back to the operational part of me, the passion for just being very plain spoken, helping people understand exactly what we're doing and what we're not doing and how what they need to do on the other hand. And it really makes a difference. We've had very complicated processes around registering holds on your account for different balances, and it's just accumulated over time. And so taking a hard look to try to clear all of it out really makes a difference.
I think another thing, too, in this probably goes without saying, and yet it should be said, is that often decisions, and I'm not saying particularly at Carthage, I don't think particularly any place, but often those kind of decisions get made for the ease and efficiency and convenience of those in the office versus the convenience and well-being of those whom they are serving. And it's the easiest thing in the world to come up with something that makes all the sense in the world within those four walls, but for the outsider coming in and having to navigate that, I know gigantic strides have been made here at Gateway, for instance. I've heard about them again and again on various programs, and I think at Carthage and Parkside and other places too, that reality has become more and more clear, that those have to be aspects of the college or university that civilians, if you will, on the outside can easily navigate and will find hospitable.
That's right. And part of it requires keeping better data. So knowing what groups of students are retaining or graduating at smaller rates and then trying to identify what in their experience and their interactions with different offices could be a part of that. But it's just something higher education hasn't really focused on. And so, but digging into it, we have lots of very interested, motivated, savvy folks. And so once we get the data, and this goes back to having the right software so that we can get the data quickly and then analyzing it and then working on it, it makes a huge difference.
Yeah. We're speaking with Dr. John Swallow, the president of Carthage College, on today's morning show. We have talked about or touched at least briefly on some of the things that have been created and in terms of expansion and so on. And I know that one of them that you are especially excited about is involves the field of engineering. Explain to our listeners, especially for the sake of those that don't know anything about that, what has been brought into being and what you think it means for the college.
Absolutely, Greg. So when you asked earlier, how does the board and the administration and the faculty think about new programs, one strong approach is to find programs that are adjacent to the ones you're doing, that you already have strength in, and then just build out from there. So, we had a fantastic biology and chemistry program. Now we have a nursing program. That depends on those. We had a fantastic, and still have fantastic, NASA-connected physics program. Well, engineering would be adjacent. And so we studied. We understood that there would be a significant group of students who would like to explore engineering, don't plan to be hyper-specialized, don't want to go to a school where everybody they know is an engineer, want to do this in a liberal arts context, and that this can be a source of a significant number of students, not unlike nursing. And so we made the decision to start. We hired our first director, Robert Nagel, who is absolutely fantastic, and then started the renovations that were needed. So if anyone's driven by lately and just north of the softball field, you see a new building, which is actually in Summers, not Kenosha, because it crosses the line. That's a facilities building. We love our facilities folks, but they didn't have to be in the basement of the primary central academic building, Lentz Hall.
Right.
And so that seemed a much better place for engineering. Just as an aside, having built this facilities building, our facilities folks are very excited and had to reorganize all of their stuff. But that's fine, too. And so we started the construction on the engineering suite last year. And so half of it's done, and the other half will be done this summer.
Very good. You mentioned something intriguing, which is that a given student might be really interested in studying engineering or studying nursing, for instance, in a liberal arts environment versus at another kind of school where where in a sense the study would be more laser focused with less of the other stuff. What do you see as the potential benefit of studying a field like engineering or nursing in a liberal arts environment? Which is not to say that that's the choice everybody should make, but for some, you clearly believe that there is some benefit that should be understood.
Yes, a liberal arts education, the breadth that you obtain, and we should just say here that for first-generation families, for instance, even the phrase liberal arts can be confusing. And so sometimes I just find myself saying a broad education. But a very broad education, a liberal arts education, does stretch you in lots of ways, your communication skills, your analytical skills, in different domains, so not just the one you're studying. And that really does benefit you over time. Now, sometimes you see the benefits of that later when you become a manager or something like supervisor. But I would say it's also you gain skills of empathy. You gain skills of understanding humans. So if you've been in a very technical field, these are also good skills to have in your career as you go on. And so, for instance, we think the best nurses or doctors would be liberal arts trained. We believe the best engineers would be liberal arts trained, and that we can do that. And so, yes, we do tell that to families, that we think a very broad education is what they will need, that there will be many corporations, small and medium ones in particular, but others that want a broadly trained engineer who can then specialize over time as needed, rather than assuming that their whole career is going to be, let's say, about aerospace engineering. Maybe that's going to happen, maybe not.
Right. Very good. You touched on the fact that it's fun to build new buildings, but that you also have to take care of the buildings that you have. And what would be a couple of the most important areas of focus for Carthage right now in terms of certain existing facilities that are going to be receiving a facelift of one kind or another?
Well, the one that's at the top of our list is the chapel, which is coming up on 50 years in 2025. And so thanks to Kenoshan Grace Kolakowski's $2 million commitment, we've begun the project of renovating that to be a better worship space and a better performance space, because it is heavily used, as you know, particularly for musical events, but for many other events as well. And so it needs to be flexible. It needs to, the acoustics can be improved. And so that's a very significant project that we're very excited about. It's an iconic building at the very center of campus, and it means a lot to many, many people. So that's one. Another that we hope to attend to before too long is Wartburg Auditorium, where we have a lot of theatrical productions. And then, of course, looking longer term, the original legacy residence halls, those built in the 60s, are going to need some attention.
I'm sure the students who live there would not disagree. Very good. Let's talk for a moment about the whole field of athletics and some of the interesting and important innovations and expansions that have occurred. It's a really, of course, important part of any school or university, and Carthage, of course, takes this seriously and takes pride in it with good reason.
Well, I can't start talking about athletics without talking about Joseph White, our Kenoshan student who came on a Kenosha Oak Scholarship. And actually, we've just released the names of the eight folks from Kenosha who will receive those. And for those who don't know, this is a way that Carthage gives back to Kenosha and provides full tuition scholarships to City of Kenosha residents. So Joseph White comes to Carthage to do nursing. He's happy to have this Kenosha Oak Scholarship. And then he decides he really wants to spend some time on the shot put and the weight throw. And his coaches said, you know, he'd probably be pretty good. But, you know, he hadn't done this for very long. And now he's been, like, a multiple Division III national champion. He's, like, the Division III field athlete of the year. It's incredible. And so for all the right reasons, all the right success. And then getting back to other programs that we do to continue to recruit students. So we added women's bowling, men's and women's wrestling. These were all a couple years ago. We added esports. These have made a difference. And then I'm very excited to make sure everyone has heard that we have a new football coach, Coach Pop, Matthew Papino, who's built a great staff and is already recruiting tremendously. And so we're looking forward to the future of Carthage football. So there's so much going on with the so many sports we have. But it is a vital part of what we do, and we're very proud to be as competitive as we can possibly be.
Right. And by the way, I had the pleasure of speaking with Joseph White on this program with two of his track coaches, as well as Seth Weidman, the assistant athletic director. And we had a marvelous conversation, and that was last spring before that set of nationals. And if people go into our website, WGTD.org, or Google WGTD, Greg Berg, Joseph White, Carthage Track, you can very easily pull up the recording of that interview, which is one of my all-time favorites of the whole year. What a great young man, and what a great story. And looking forward to graduating with a nursing degree and helping the world in that respect. So
yes, comes from a great family. Yes.
Terrific. Well, we have just a couple of minutes left, and I want to give you the opportunity to touch on anything that you think is important to say that we haven't had a chance to get to.
Well, you're right, Greg. There's so much to talk about. I'm so pleased to be talking about it with you. And I'll just say one more thing. Some of you may know that Carthage has been connected to a group called Braver Angels that helps people talk across political difference. My wife particularly, Cameron, has been a volunteer and co-state coordinator. And we're very pleased to announce that this summer, the National Convention of Braver Angels will be at Carthage in late June. And so if anyone is interested in depolarization work, as it's called, or just talking across difference, we'd love to get in contact with you.
Yeah. Boy, I can't think of anything that is more timely. And I've had the pleasure of speaking with her on several different occasions about this organization, which I think originally was called Better Angels.
Yes.
And then at some point
it was already copyrighted.
Right. And beyond that, of course, it takes often great bravery, I mean great courage, in order to speak one's mind, but also to reach across these enormous and sometimes very painful and bitter political divides that separate us from each other. And so this organization is a tremendous force for good, and so we look forward to talking with her and others as this national convention convenes on the beautiful campus of Carthage College. That really is a tremendous plus, I should think, too, in terms of the ongoing success of the school, is that campus and where it's located in terms of drawing events like this.
That's right. Well, we need to be using all of our buildings all the time.
Very good. Well, I certainly appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to touch on a whole lot of different aspects of the functioning of Carthage College, and appreciate each and every opportunity to speak with you. Dr. John Swallow, the president of Carthage College, thank you for giving your time today to the
Morning
Show.
Thank you, Greg. It was wonderful.
Tomorrow on the Morning Show, to observe Women's History Month, Rebecca Roberts and Lucinda Robb talk about their book, The Suffragist Playbook, Your Guide to Changing the World, which looks at some of the most important women who led the suffragist movement and their lessons for would-be activists today. On Wednesday, I speak with a most impressive young student from Park High School in Racine, Aubrey Marquez, who is an apprentice at Delta Hawk, a very exciting young company in Racine. On Thursday, sports journalist and podcaster Anne Liguori with her book Life on the Green. This Friday, Dr. Thomas Carr and Dr. Megan Seitz from Carthage's paleontology program. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. is for cloudy skies today, some precipitation possible, and a high temperature of just 39 degrees. Tomorrow, under partly cloudy skies, will warm to 53, back into chilly territory both Wednesday and Thursday. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News.